This morning you talked about the mind and the intellect. Mind or manas, intellect being the buddhi. But isn't there a big element of ego-ness or the I sense that's involved in this whole business of attachment?
Yeah.
So the question is, so do you distinguish between the two in this regard?
I will try to give a analysis of the antakaranas, including mana, buddhi, chitta, and ahankara. I will take the example that I gave this morning. Suppose you see an object from a distance, which you mistake. It's a really iron pillar, which you mistake to be a human figure. First, the mind speculates whether a human being or something else. Then you reach there, you decide with your intellect that this is an iron pillar. And then you suddenly remember that you have seen the same iron pillar last week or maybe last day. So your chittam retains the memories. So it comes to the forefront, which enables you to remember yourself as the seer of the same object. So aham comes. So this is how these four components constitute antakarana, internal organs. Now, in the conflict between mind and intellect, ego is involved, but through spiritual practice, when you bridge the gap, the aham vritti gets sublimated or refined or purified. So yes, I shall try to explain. Now, to go back to the previous example, I'll give an illustration. We read a book, we listen to lecture, or we discuss with somebody, and suddenly we feel a strong desire to practice meditation. Any person for that. But then that person doesn't have the support of his own inner chamber. So what happens? His mind sometimes creates hurdles, problems. So naturally, you find that person's mind splits into two. One part is with the intellect, but I must meditate. The other part tries to create problems. The other part is related to the negative impulses, negative memories, negative impulses. In the process, the ego also gets divided into two. The subject of discussion is the conflict between intellect and mind for information. So I repeat the question. So now what happens, you know? So the ego also gets split into one part of intellect. Well, I want to meditate. The other part with one fraction of the mind. Well, the mind sometimes plays a very nasty hypocritical game. Mind suddenly plays a false, tries to give false justification for not doing what you really want to do, what will be beneficial for you to do. Otherwise, spiritual practice will be very simple. You know, our chittam is a huge bag full of memories, impressions, vasanas, and samskaras. Some of them are very good, some of them are not so very good. The bad ones will associate with this hypocritical aspect of the mind. The good ones will support your intellect. Go and meditate. So, in this case, ego gets refined when you repeat your effort to meditate again and again. Because that effort will accumulate, will create new vrittis and vasanas. Because in the bag, which is your chitta, mind stuff, as I said, there are all kinds of memories and samskaras and vrittis which belong to two categories, good and bad ones. Depending upon the preponderance, the domination, you are able to do things good or bad. So when good samskaras in favor, they are paramount, they're predominant, then you are able to practice meditation. How to increase good samskaras? By repeated effort. And every effort produces a new positive vrittis, so that the bad samskaras become the minority. Good samskaras attain the majority. In the sense, they become more dominant. That's why You know, when in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find Sri Ramakrishna sometimes when we encountered some spiritual seekers, you have got good samskaras. So you found they are able to meditate more easily. So when we meditate, or when that's of course more abstract, but even ordinary spiritual practice like prayer, for example, even when we may sign up RSVP, the last moment, oh, there is a wonderful thing going on, I would rather go to the retreat next year. This year I will go something else. Even very ordinary, gross activities, you can find in these activities the influence of the good and bad samskaras. So very often we can increase the good samskaras, and once we try to increase good samskaras, we will be eventually successful, if not today, tomorrow. So keep doing good things, good thoughts. Please come, continue.
Ego sense is sublimated, you mean the good part of it. When the ego sense is sublimated, you mean most of the ego part goes to the good side of it.
Exactly.
It never gets destroyed, really?
No, when you get established in good spiritual practices, you know, then it is possible for you to get established. Once we go deeper and deeper into spiritual practices, when you have a natural liking for spiritual practices, then what it means, your ego is now supporting you. What we have a natural liking for, that is where our ego stands. Suppose you go to a library and there is nobody to watch you. There are all kinds of books, good and bad. There is nobody to supervise you. What will we choose to read? If you have got complete autonomy, that's our natural tendency. So that natural tendency reflects our real ego. In the previous example that you gave, where there's a conflict between mind and intellect, the natural tendency has not become natural. You're trying to make it natural by practicing meditation, but it has got an equally strong opposition, which tries to drag you away from spiritual practices.
Earlier this morning, somebody talked about when you have the experience of the Atman, it's a very joyful experience. Now, things like joy, sadness, pain, all those things, they're associated with the individual. So by the time you get to that stage of experiencing the Atman, you're supposed to have gotten rid of the I-ness. Mm. So who is it that feels it then?
Yeah. Now, the joy that is mentioned in the context of Atman experience is totally different and distinct from the joy that is associated with ordinary worldly things in the worldly context in we used word joy. There's a verse in the Gita, Sukham Atyantikam Yetat Buddhi Grahim Atintriyam. Sukham means enjoyment. Atyantikam means absolute, paramount. It means without its opposite. The joy that is associated with spiritual experience is not the absence of sorrow. In the empirical sense, when you get joy, when you become rich, it is only the joy that is rooted in the absence of poverty, in the absence of its opposite. In the empirical sense, everything is in dual, like a coin with two sides. In the worldly sense, enjoyment in the worldly sense is only the opposite of sorrow. It is not real enjoyment. You are enjoying the absence of sorrow, that's all. Not really, you are not enjoying enjoyment. You are only enjoying the absence of sorrow. But the real enjoyment is atyantika, means without its opposite. Like a coin with only one side. It is inconceivable. So it's called atyantikam, the absolute, the paramount. And that's buddhigrahim atyantikam. It is beyond the perception by mind or intellect. Enjoyment in the empirical sense, which is nothing but the absence of sorrow, can be perceived, understood intellectually and mentally, psychologically. But the joy of spiritual experience, the joy of real contentment, is beyond description. So it is beyond buddhi, beyond intellect, and beyond the senses. You cannot explain it. That's why true contentment is beyond words. It is a kind of indescribable, inexplicable, undefinable experience. It can only be explained by experience. So this is an interesting thing. And mind you, this is the common universal experience of all great mystics in all traditions. You find all the great mystics in all traditions, they could withstand torture. See, you find the St. Teresa of Avila, that autobiography you read, the way of a pilgrim, what a pilgrim had to go through during his travels, you find. He was beaten, he was ambushed, and so on. You find great spiritual personalities who had to suffer so much. But you feel miserable for them, but they didn't feel miserable about themselves. Because atmani eva atmana tushtaka, their enjoyment, their contentment was something trans-empirical. It was not a sensory enjoyment. That should be understood. Enjoyment in the worldly sense is not enjoyment. It is only the absence of its opposite, the absence of sorrow. But enjoyment in the spiritual sense is like a coin with only one side, without its opposite. It is not the absence of its opposite. It's called sukham atyandikam. Sukha means enjoyment. Same word is used, but it is called absolute. It's clear? So, actually, yeah, that's, yes, exactly. So, atmani eva atmana tushtaka means that is why it cannot be explained. See, when there is subject-object distinction, then only description is possible, definition is possible. When it is an essentially subjective experience, it is buddhigrahimati, it means it is beyond description, beyond definition, it is beyond comprehension by intellect or mind. Yes.
It's more of a, want to get your comment. In a practical sense, we live in a society today where ambition is respected, and particularly here in Silicon Valley and everywhere, people want you to exhibit passion and excitement. And the whole element of being calm and collected and balanced in the real world sometimes may not be perceived as a positive trait. Right? Love to hear your comment on that.
They may even consider you as there is something wrong with you, you know. They may think because you don't have the dash and push and drive, so it becomes a negative virtue. It could happen. Well, that's true, but you can have all these characteristics in your office, but when there is a problem of job insecurity, then this philosophy will help you to keep in a state of poise. That's the real value. So you find, that's why we already discussed this morning, Rajashi ideal. That word Rajashi is defined Rajanascha Rishayascha Rajashi. It means people who are both kings and also rishis, philosophers. That's what, of course, Plato thought in the Republic. He thought that a king who is a philosopher, and a philosopher is king, is the best person to rule a city, rule a state eventually. So the point is, they were men of great zeal, enthusiasm, and action. But in the midst of their activities, they could keep themselves in a state of equanimity, poise, and balance. They could do that because in the midst of all these activities, they were aware of their limitations. So even if you are the richest person in the world, still if you are fully aware of the limitation of being rich, then you may be rich, but that won't affect you mentally. A person may be poor, but still he could be very worldly, always looking for more and more. So the point is, even kings could be spiritual, and kings had to be active, hyperactive rather. So in the midst of efficiency, in the midst of competitive professionalism, one can have this inner poise. That's the real purpose of it. They are not mutually contradictory. So any more questions?
Yes, share with us the interrelationship of the Maha Atman and the Jiva Atman.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. That means the relationship between Jivatma and Paramatma. Paramatma and Mahatma, Paramatma. Okay. Yeah. Now, Jivatma is the Paramatman seen, embodied in this body, mind, intellect complex mechanism. This embodiment doesn't affect us, affect this Paramatman. So the example is given in the light of three imageries in Vedantic text. So there are three approaches in Vedantic terminology. One is Avachedavada, Bimba Pratibimbavada, and Abhasavada. These are technical things we explain. Suppose you have a pot. There is space within the pot. There is space outside the pot. The space outside the pot is called Paramatman. The space within the pot, which appears to be limited by the dimension of the pot, is called Jivatman. But really, the space outside and inside the pot, they are not different. But then, it appears to be different. The space within the pot appears to be limited by the size and shape of the pot. It's really an illusion. Why? You break the pot, which is easy. You find the space within the pot merges with the space with the outside the pot. So Mahakasha is the space outside the pot. Then the Ghatakasha, is called the Jivatma, is within the pot. So they are the same, but they appear to be limited by this embodiment. This is a school of thought according to Avachedavada, a school of Vedanta upheld by Vajaspati Mishra, who wrote Bhamadi, which is a commentary on Shankaracharya's Brahma Sutra Bhashya, the earlier portion of it. So Avacheda means Antapravesha, which means embodiment. So in a way, we are like pots. But the moment we realize that this body is not going to be permanent, and this mind and intellect are only reflecting media for the Atman to manifest, to reflect on, that moment, even while living with this body, we realize our non-distinction, non-difference with the Mahakasha or Paramatman. That state is called the Jivan Mukta state. The same relationship is explained in the light of Bimba Pratibimbavada, where a mirror is a reflecting medium and the is a prototype and the original sun. Now, or your own face. Your face seen reflected in the mirror is not the same, because you go give a blow to the image on the mirror, you won't feel hurt. So they are not the same, but at the same time, without your existence, the reflection cannot exist. Only when the mirror is shown in front of your face, then only your face will be reflected in the mirror. So they are mutually interdependent, but they are not the same. This is called a Bimba Pratibimbavada. That means, Pratibimba means reflection, Bimba means the real, your face. This is one school. So this school was, this analysis method was adopted by Padmapada and Sarvajnana Muni and others. This is another, the second school. The third school, the Abhasavada, where it means, you know, you have a crystal and a red flower. If you bring the red flower near the crystal, you feel, you find that, or you may think that the crystal gets the red color, but actually it is only by proximity. It is called Abhasavada. So with the Sureshwaracharya. So these three great philosophical schools have analyzed this relationship in three different ways. There is no basic difference, because all these three schools became distinct during the post-Shankarite period. So Sureshwara was a disciple of Shankaracharya, who was, wrote the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Bhashyavartika, and other books. And then Padmapada wrote Panchapadika, this again. Eh? And then Vajaspati wrote the Bhamati, which is a tika on Shankaracharya's Bhashya, Brahma Sutra, the early portion. So these are three different ways of analyzing the Jivatma Paramatma relationship and the world and Paramatma relationship. Right. Of course, this is, but thank you for the question, little serious Vedantic discussion also. Very welcome in the midst of all this. Purely academic, that also makes it serious discussions. Okay. Okay, okay. Can you give the use the instrument? Okay.
This morning you spoke about impermanence.
Ah.
Impermanence would apply that there's permanence.
I will try to explain.
Correct. So what in Vedanta,
yeah,
what permanence,
yes, yes,
is there? Because, you know, many times we say in the navigation of the night,
yeah,
we right, follow the North, yeah, Star, which is permanent.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now I would give a detailed analysis of the three levels of reality in Vedanta. So compared to one, the other is permanent or impermanent, I'll tell you. So first, this world in which we are living, of which we are a part, which we experience, the empirical world, this is impermanent only in the sense that it is subject to change. It is impermanent in the sense that it is subject to change. Anything which is subject to change as our body or our mind or this universe, it may be billions of years old. Before the Big Bang, the universe did not exist. After the big crunch, if it happens, this world won't exist. So this universe, which may exist for billions of years, is as impermanent as an insect that may live for a few split seconds or minutes, because both belong to time. See, anything that belongs to time, as a birth, existence, and disappearance, death or vanishing. So birth or origination is a transition from a state of non-existence to a state of existence. Then it exists, then it disappears, which is nothing but a transition from a state of existence to a state of non-existence. So this universe is impermanent in the sense it is subject to change. In both ways, the universe itself will be different after several billions of years. It was different before it came into existence. So it belongs to time. It is not beyond time. And anything that belongs to time will be limited by space concept. And it will have a cause. So time, space and causation, which constitute the relativity or Maya in Vedanta, is applicable to this empirical universe. And anything that belongs to time, space and causation cannot be permanent in the absolute sense of the word permanent. In the relative sense, it is permanent. Why? For example, what about, I can give this example in the light of the famous imagery, the Jusarpa Bhranti, you know, the rope and snake imagery. You think of a room which is not well lit, which is semi-dark, you can't see, and there is an object lying on the table. It is somewhat curved. It looks like a snake, but actually it is a piece of rope. Because there is not enough light, the windows are half closed. When you open the windows or when you switch on the electric light, what happens, you know, suddenly you realize that it is not a rope. Sorry, it is not a snake, it is a rope. Now, you can't ask the question, where did the snake vanish? The answer is, it did not vanish anywhere because it did not exist there to begin with. So then where did the snake exist before you opened the windows or you switched on the light? It existed in your mind. It existed in your mind, a snake idea. Now, a snake idea cannot exist if a thing like a snake is totally non-existent in this world. The snake exists in the forests, which you have seen last day. Or the snake is then the zoo, which you have seen. And that in memory in your mind, you superimposes on the piece of rope which resembles the snake. The snake, is it totally unreal? No. It is unreal here, but it's real in the zoo. It is not just an idea. It is an idea in the sense it doesn't exist here, but it exists somewhere else. So compared to the status of reality of the snake, the rope is more real. Compared to the impermanent condition of the snake, the piece of rope which is there and right in front of you is more permanent, more real. But this rope will not exist after 100 years. Or maybe after the world has come to an end, if it ever happens. So the rope belongs to the empirical world. The snake belongs to an idea world, but it's not totally unreal because it stays there. Now, what about Brahman, the absolute reality, the highest reality? So Brahman or Atman is the supreme principle from where everything emerges. It is beyond description, beyond words, beyond explanation. And when you meditate, when you do spiritual practices, you feel that there is a reality within you which is beyond anything that is empirical, which is beyond anything that is related to the body or mind or intellect. And that is the Atman. And that can only be experienced. It can never be explained. So whatever you explain is only relatively real. The absolute reality can never be explained because it is beyond verbalization. It is beyond intellectual cognition or comprehension. And that is in Vedanta, Paramarthika Satta, Brahman or Atman. This world is only a common sense reality, a relative reality. This idea. There are three levels of reality in Vedanta. Okay? That's all. I mean, something that exists only as ideas, but they are not totally unreal. They don't exist in front of you. They exist somewhere else. Then the relative world in which we live, and in the absolute reality, Brahman or Atman. So Paramarthika Satta, Brahman or Atman, Vyavahariga Satta, this empirical world, and then Pradibhasika Satta, like the snake idea, etc. This is the thing. Thank you. Okay, so thank you. We'll continue the discussion tomorrow. Though for those of you who are interested, you may know already that we have Sunday lectures here every Sunday, and we have Patanjali Yoga Sutra classes held here every Friday evening from 7:30 to 8:30 every Friday. Of course, right now we are in Christmas recess. After Christmas recess is over, from 17th onwards, we will continue our classes. So next Friday onwards, we will have classes on Yoga Sutras. So thank you. So tomorrow again we will have a session at 10 a.m. here in the same hall, the same subject. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.